Okay, this is the faculty panel. This is the philosophy and theory section. Downstairs is the history section. What we do is go through questions for 45 minutes here, and then we allow you to switch. You can either stay here or you can go downstairs for a 45-minute dose of history questions. This has always been a popular event at Mises University. It can be a very valuable event. A lot of these lectures, you've not been able to ask questions, and this is the place where we do that. We try to get all the questions answered for you this week. We begin with the written questions, and then after the written questions, if they are exhausted, we turn to questions from the floor. Okay, the first question is, what is the relationship between utilitarianism and libertarianism, and is there a necessary relationship between utilitarianism and socialism?
Utilitarianism is a particular moral theory. There are various versions of it. So it doesn't have any particular relationship to libertarianism. Libertarianism is a view about the state or the proper right, various rights people have, or free market and so on. So one is a moral theory and one is a particular political philosophy. There are various people who are utilitarians who have argued for libertarianism, and there are also libertarians who are strongly opposed to utilitarianism. So there's no necessary connection between utilitarianism and socialism. There have been, again, utilitarians who were socialists, and some socialists were anti-utilitarians. So there's no necessary connection either between them, either support or opposition.
I'll just add a quick line to that. I mean, strictly speaking, even if you don't think that utilitarianism is right, you still might think that, you know, the best version of utilitarianism would be libertarianism, because libertarianism, in fact, has better consequences, even if you don't think consequences are the sole test. Or even the main test of a moral theory. And particularly those versions of utilitarianism that stress indirect rather than direct pursuit of ends. So rather than having the government try to decide which policy can we do right now that will produce the greatest total benefit right now, what general policies and practices tend to have the best results in the long term, if you do that, you'll get something that looks broadly libertarian, even if it doesn't look exactly the same as a more natural rights-based version would look.
Second question. What is the best argument against the Austrian theory of the business cycle?
Rod, you want to say anything about that?
Yeah. I'm at a loss for words. No. I think the best criticism and one that Mises took into account and took seriously was that entrepreneurs can learn from their mistakes in past cycles, and that he said on a number of occasions, certainly in Human Action, that if entrepreneurs were to use the newly expanded credit not to expand their operations, not to invest in loan, but just to pay wages, then the cycle would come to, then there would not be a business cycle. But the way he phrased it was, if at some point in the future this occurs. So I think that has the most weight. But Rod, do you want to comment on that?
Actually, I think I'd rather criticize the point you just made. essentially, what you're talking about is what's going to be the old rational expectations argument against it. And I think that rational expectations, that whole theory, is largely misconceived or misperceived. And essentially, the whole concept of rational expectations takes its meaning from the theoretical framework in which it's invoked. Okay? So if you have a very simple framework such as MV equal PQ, and you assume rational expectations, well, that just means that people, on average, have a pretty good prediction about what the inflation rate's likely to be. And they may well have that, okay? But if you try to impose rational expectations in an Austrian framework, well, that implies that people have a pretty good idea what prices would be if they weren't distorted by government actions, if they weren't distorted by credit expansion. So in other words, the whole idea is that the credit expansion falsifies prices. And knowing even that prices are falsified doesn't tell you what the non-falsified prices are. It's not as if you really know what prices ought to be, and so you're not going to be fooled with what they actually are. And even if you did know what prices ought to be, you wouldn't have the incentive to act on that basis. You couldn't go to some factor owner, and he tells you what price he wants for his factor, and you say, yes, but I want to pay the price that it ought to be if the Fed weren't expanding the money supply. You can't do that. So it just, once you assume rational expectations in an Austrian model, the whole thing just blows up.
Okay? Just add a quick analogy to that. Imagine that you are traveling out in the wilderness somewhere, and you've got a compass, and someone says, there's a big magnetic anomaly over in that direction somewhere that'll tend to throw off your compass somewhat in that direction. So you look at your compass, and you see that north is pointing in that direction. So you think, well, it's probably not quite there. But that's not adequate information to tell you where the heck north actually is. You just know, well, it's probably not, it's probably somewhere to the right of where this is, or somewhere to the left of where it is. But that's not adequate information to get you unlost.
Okay. I thought I saw Guido going after the mic.
But just in order to reinforce what Joe said initially and in favor of the rational expectations so to say, argument, well, it's not really an argument that is bound up only with the rational expectations paradigm that emerged in the late 1960s, early 1970s. I mean, Mises himself, in starting from the first edition of the Theory of Money and Credit, made this argument, though in a slightly different context. He said, what might be the reaction of market participants, of entrepreneurs, to an increase of the supply of fiduciary media? He said, well, they might start taking out more loans because the competition from other entrepreneurs might force them into this direction. So the demand for credits might increase due to this increased entrepreneurial demand. And as a consequence, the interest rate would not be artificially diminished. So he admitted this as a possible, not as a likely, but as a possible scenario right in this first edition. And I think it's we shouldn't go to the extent of saying, well, it's always a necessary consequence that an increase or artificial increase of the money supply necessarily entails a reduction of the interest rate below its equilibrium level, and therefore necessarily entails an intertemporal disequilibrium. That's a possibility, and it's even a likely possibility, but it might not be the case in actual practice, and so we need to keep this as in our, so to say, in our theoretical toolbox as a possible scenario to explain real-world scenario. So it might be the case that in the past 5 or 10 years, entrepreneurs have understood these incentives, and to some extent they certainly did. Right? I mean, the availability of easy credit coming from our present monetary system, and the present banking system premised on fiat money, has found a reaction on the side of entrepreneurs who have, to a very large extent, finance firms and other organizations out of debt. So we cannot exclude that this increase of the supply of fiduciary media did not go in hand with intertemporal disequilibrium, at least not in the form that Mises envisioned it in his business cycle theory.
Next question. Can labor curves slope backwards? Did Rothbard make a mistake?
Yeah, I think there can be backward sloping supply curves for labor because from the aggregate point of view, from the market supply curves for labor. The reason is that at the same time that prices are going up and eliciting more labor from the laborer, the marginal utility of leisure that he's giving up is also going up. Marginal utility of the money he's receiving is going down. So at some point, he might actually, at the higher wage rate, actually supply less. So I don't think Rothbard was wrong on that at all.
Okay, next question. Could you comment on George Selgin's opinion against 100% deposit banking reserve proposal? Part two, what is your opinion about other free market ideal monetary regimes, Hayek, Ben Klein, Selgin, White, Greenfield, Jaeger? First one is, could you comment on George Selgin's opinion against 100% deposit banking reserve proposal? Yes.
Selgin does not make the point so much against 100% reserve proposal, more he makes it in favor of his fractional reserve free banking system. And he says that... Well, with a 100% reserve system, it may is not as good as a free banking system because if the demand for money or for bank liabilities increase, then fractional reserve banks will increase credit and reestablish monetary equilibrium. While in a 100% reserve system, this the money supply is more or less inelastic. So their prices would have to adapt downwards. And as there's some sluggishness or rigidity, there will be an unnecessary drop in output. So now I shall comment on this argument, which we could talk hours about this.
No.
Yeah. So the main problem is that, as Mises says, there's no amount of normal credit expansion, that any credit expansion leads to the forces that start an artificial boom. So the main problem with the fractional reserve banking system is that it allows for this credit expansion that reduces artificially interest rates, which then results in the bust.
Yeah, I get. Is it okay? I was just going to say that the way I understand George Selgin is that one thing he points to is the centralization of the banking system as the key problem and not per se the fractional reserve banking. I was at a conference with him a few months ago where he offered an analogy that I think works, although I have to be apologetic about it a little bit. And that is that Selgin recognized we have a central bank, then the other banks that the central bank directs are just working in lockstep, essentially, maintaining reserves as required by the central bank. But if you have competitive banking and no central bank, then fractional reserves don't pose the same threat. And the analogy he used is think of the competitive banks as analogous to members of a chain gang. And this is here's the apology. We who support market solutions don't like to think of competitive firms as members of a chain gang, okay? But suppose they are, okay? You think of them as members of a chain gang. Then that serves a purpose the same as the chain is in a real chain gang. In other words, no one of them can go very far from the rest of the gang because they're chained to them. They can't expand their credit to any great extent. They'll do themselves in rather than doing the economy in. And on the other hand, they can't all run away at the same time because they don't have the coordination that would allow them to successfully do that. All right? And so competition provides the restraint of overexpansion by competitive banking. That's what George is arguing. And I guess if we wanted a different analogy to capture the idea of a central banking, it would be banks not as members of a chain gang, but as duck-stepping soldiers that would march to the orders of the central bank. That's where you have the problem. But again, the problem is in the centrality of it all and not in the business of fractional reserves.
All Austrian economists agree that central banking is an inferior institutional setup as compared to competition. So the disagreement concerns only the workability, desirability of something like fractional reserve banking. And there, George Selgin, indeed, he argues, as Philip Bagos has pointed out, he argues that if you don't have fractional reserves, there are deflationary tendencies, and this might create problems for the operation of the market economy. So it's a Keynesian argument. And the other argument that he makes is that in competition, that there would be no tendency for the banking, fractional reserve banking system as a whole to expand. Now, that's not actually what I believe, and what Philip Bagos also believes, and I think Joe Salerno too. Mises himself has pointed out that in a competitive fractional reserve banking system, there is the tendency for banks to increase the overall money supply. They do this. Of course, they cannot go as far as when they are coordinated by a central bank, or if they are coordinated by regular roundtable meetings and so on. So if they're really competitive, they proceed more slowly, but they proceed nevertheless. And so you get this extension of the money supply, and it might then entail intertemporal disequilibria. And even if it does not, it entails two other problems that I think should be stressed. The one is the increasing fragility of the banking system as a whole. Even if there are no intertemporal disequilibria, the banking system in expansion then operates at a lower liquidity ratio and therefore becomes more vulnerable to unforeseen events, which then would entail a meltdown of the banking industry. And the other issue is, of course, the issue of justice. I mean, is it just that by increasing tickets uncovered by money in the narrow sense, by base money, the banks can enrich themselves and their customers at the expense of all other money users?
Question from the floor.
Okay, I'm going to comment on...
No questions. Questions.
No, it's a question. It issues out in a question. In the critique you guys provided of the old rational expectation critique of Austrian business cycle theory, it almost appears as if you're relying on a sort of Hayekian theory of entrepreneurship, or at least a Hayekian theory of the function of prices in the market process, because it would seem that for the Misesian theory of entrepreneurship, what entrepreneurs are doing is assessing real conditions and determining what they believe will be the future structure of relative prices that will prevail in the future, right? So I'm just wondering, how do you reconcile the Misesian conception of entrepreneurship with the response that you guys gave to the old rational expectations critique of the Austrian business cycle theory without relying on this more Hayekian notion?
Sure.
I'm not sure the difference between Mises and Hayek is quite as you say. Mises, after all, in his book on socialism, talks about the importance of prices in allocating resources and figuring out what the real factors are. And in fact, that's the link between nominal prices and real factors. Prices are a clue about what the real factors are. Rational expectations, not with the term, but the concept, is much older than 1961 when John Muth introduced that term. Hicks, when he criticized Hayek's theory, indicated that he didn't see what Hayek was getting at, because if people paid attention to the real factors only, there wouldn't be any cycle. Is that right? Well, yeah, I guess if they really knew what the real factors were. But in fact, it's prices that give them a clue about what the real factors are. And I think that's consistent with Mises as well as Hayek.
Just to support Roger, Mises always stressed the necessity of monetary calculation, that it's prices that direct resources. Now, Jake was right by pointing out that you use past prices only as experience. They're not marching orders. They simply guide you. And that it helps you to appraise or to estimate future prices. But still, you react to the anticipated prices and your cost of production. No one looks can really see the ratios of the real factors, the real ratios. Okay, a barter economy of that type wouldn't progress at all.
Oh, next question. Which philosophical frontiers are being advanced, and which should we think about advancing?
You want to take a shot?
Well, I must say I don't have the remotest idea what's meant there by philosophical frontiers, so I don't know quite. I mean, I think there's all sorts of interesting topics one could pursue, like what is the exact nature of the knowledge claims in praxeology, or what is the that would be one case, or you could follow up various topics that say, are there differences between Rothbard and Mises in accounting for praxeology? But I'm not sure there are any really great issues that need to be addressed that haven't been, other than disposing of Molyneux or no.
All right, good. David's taking it first, gave me a chance to think. A couple of possibilities that come to mind are we're thinking about integrating Austrian insights with other research projects going on in philosophy. So integrating praxeology with theories in philosophy of mind and philosophy of action, for example. So that's the kind of thing that comes to mind. Also, there's been a lot of interest in the question of integrating how to integrate subjective value theory and praxeology with objective value and ethics, which Mises thought you shouldn't do, but Rothbard thought you should. And that's something I think is worth pursuing.
Next question. In arguing for an anarcho-capitalist society, do you think that the morality or the efficiency of the society is more important? I guess that's the morality or the efficiency argument is more important.
Well, I find that sort of an odd question, because it's like, suppose you've got a double-barreled shotgun. Which barrel should you use? I think that it's important to use both, because there are people who might resist the economic arguments if they're worried about the morality of it, or people might resist the morality of it if they think that it's economically not feasible. And since we've got good arguments on both fronts, and they're mutually supporting. I think that we ought to put a lot of emphasis on both. So I mean, since I'm not a utilitarian, I suppose in some sense I think the moral argument is more important inherently. But I think in strategic terms, I think they're equally important.
Just one point. I agree with that. I just add that if you say that the free market is more efficient, that itself, of course, can be a moral argument. I mean, even if you're not a utilitarian, that certainly, it's not irrelevant to morality that the free market is most efficient system, at least on most plausible views of morality.
I just want to make one quick comment. I'm not a philosopher, but when I do teach economics, and if people ask me questions on the market economy, what I try to do is give them the utilitarian arguments initially, certainly, that price controls lead to shortages and black markets and so on. Drug prohibition has similar effects. Increases the money supply leads to inflation and business cycles. And then later on, as the examples accumulate, you can then say, they're ripping us off. It's just a bunch of thieves. And, there you can bring the ethical stuff in. So I always use utilitarian first. Walter Block actually advises that you do the reverse, that the justice issue should be up front, strategically, and then utilitarianism comes second. But I don't see that as working as well.
Question from the floor.
In the lecture on deflation yesterday, Professor Holzman, you mentioned that there's a small group of Austrians, including Hayek, who believe that deflation was in some ways problematic. Could y'all explain what their position was on deflation, why they did fear it?
Well, Hayek is an interesting case because Hayek, at least in his earlier work, he admitted that price deflation per se, if it results, for example, from a growth process, is non-problematic. But in that same earlier work, he also stressed the desirability of the stabilization of aggregate demand. And so if aggregate demand diminished, that would appear to him to be problematic for arguments that are ultimately not very different from the arguments that are typically advanced by Keynesian economists. Now, in his later work, if you look, for example, at the denationalization of money, and Hayek presents as desirable as a monetary system in which the money unit preserves its purchasing power. There's a stabilization of the purchasing power. And he recommends competition in money precisely because he expects a stabilization of the purchasing power to be the outcome of such a competitive process. Whereas under our current monopolistic monetary system, the outcome is regularly a depreciation of the purchasing power of money. And that is by and large, therefore, I mentioned this as the Visarian branch of Austrian economics, because the first economist to articulate this position was Visar. So Visa thought that was the desirable policy objective, to have a stabilization of aggregate demand. And today the same position is argued by, most notably by George Selgin and by Lawrence White, both in recent publications. And so all of them, right to their credit, do not see any problem in price deflation to the extent that it results from higher productivity, but they see a problem in deflation to the extent that it results from a variation of monetary factors.
Next question. The words rational allocation are needed in Mises's economic calculation argument against socialism. This phrase is often defined as the direction of resources to their most highly valued ends. But most highly valued ends, to whom exactly? If we say society, then it's as if we are adding up people's values, which is impossible due to the ordinal nature of value and interpersonal comparability of value.
Well, in my lecture, I address that. I know who asked this question, so I'll repeat my answer to you.
yeah, he's got his name on here, too.
all production is oriented towards consumption. So it is consumer ends that are the criterion of efficiency. When you have a Crusoe economy, there's no problem. There's direct valuation. You can tell what you like more and what you like less, and you can economize your resources accordingly. When you have an advanced division of labor and you have exchange, and there are, it's correct to say, no possibility of comparing directly comparing people's valuations. However, we have this subjective information transformed by the price system into objective price data. Price data not only for the consumer's goods, but for the producer's goods, capital goods, land, so on. That means that entrepreneurs are able to compare price and output, price and cost of production, and they can allocate their resources accordingly. So from the aggregate consumer point of view, when resources are moved into an area where they have a higher value, that's exhibited by profits, then what has happened is that the resources have been moved from lower value to higher valued uses. So in that sense, they're serving the more urgent demands of consumers, okay, as expressed through the price system.
Yeah, ultimately, it's a very good question. Right? Ultimately, the answer boils down to an argument in terms of property rights. Right? To the extent that property rights are justly held by those who spend the money, well, to the extent we can say, well, this the outcome of the market process is preferable to any alternative outcome. So, the statement made by Mises and by Rothbard in this context, right, and by us also today, because we express ourselves similarly, right, is tautological, right? Ultimately, it's based on a certain assessment of the desirability of property regimes.
One last point. Mises always says, when he's talking about the market economy, that resources tend to move to the most urgent consumer demands. He doesn't use ends or values there, okay, or the highest valued use as valued by market prices.
This is a little bit off our topic, but it's probably pretty important. If our end is to gain an education in Austrian economics, and we are currently in an undergraduate institution that exclusively teaches mainstream economics, should we pursue that course or perhaps another means such as philosophy?
Well, there are other alternatives. You can switch college and go to Grove City College. So get an Austrian education. You can also go to Loyola University in New Orleans. They also have an Austrian program. So there are various things that you can do before falling in complete desperation and choose to study philosophy.
Come to philosophy. You don't need to know any math.
Question. Can a Rothbardian be a determinist? Speak into the mic, please.
Well, I think certainly Rothbard wasn't a determinist, but I guess you just have to try to figure out whether opposition to determinism is an integral part of his political philosophy. I don't think offhand that it would, although if you took him to be sort of the whole Rothbardianism, to be kind of the whole philosophical and ethical system he gave you, he argued against determinism. But I guess you just have to decide how central you think that is to his system. I don't think there's a fixed answer to that. It's not, at least I'm not being determined to suggest such a fixed answer. I'm freely choosing not to give one.
Well, the word determinist or determinist philosophy is used in two different senses. One, in the sense there's no cause of a
a choice. One and the other, in the sense, there's always a constant cause. Now, of course, in the sense of a constant cause, we can generalize that we always make a certain choice under the influence of that or another factor. Of course, you cannot believe in this. In fact, no serious philosopher has ever believed that, at least from medieval times onward, that this held true for human action. For antiquity is somewhat different, right? Aristotle and Plato, they had the tendency to conceive of human beings as some sort of more developed rabbits, right? So you tend to be determined. But, I mean, so there's no contradiction between believing in freedom of choice on the one hand and believing in determinism on the other hand. Mises himself said in Theory and History that all philosophical speculation leads to determinism. Very stark statement. And with this, he had in mind probably most notably Aristotle's metaphysics, right, which pointed to this direction, but also you find the same thing in Thomas Aquinas, right, in Summa Contra Gentiles. You have this, he highlights right, that ultimately there is, everything is determined by a prior cause. Now, again, this does not mean that in the case of choice that we are determined in a mechanical way. Right? So there might be different causes at work at every different moment, and in fact there are. There's no contradiction between asserting on the one hand that human choice is being determined and on the other hand saying that human beings are free. And that is, I take it, also the position that that Mises held, and you could apply the same thing to Rothbard's position.
I think in both the Aristotelian tradition and in the Austrian tradition, an action's being motivated is to be thought of less as it's being kicked off by some prior motivational event and more as a matter of what's currently structuring the action. And so, therefore, you can say that all actions are motivated without saying that they're all necessitated by earlier events. And that's also how for what it's worth, I read Aristotle and Aquinas as well. But I think this is also relevant to this. There's another dispute that sometimes comes up in Austrian economics as to whether there's such a thing as indifference. I think to some extent there, you know, it depends what you're talking about. In the moment of choosing, you cannot be indifferent between the thing you're choosing and something else because you're choosing it. But when people say, "Oh, aren't we indifferent all the time and just choose randomly?" I think they're right. But the way in which they're right is that, you know, prior to that moment, you might very well have. But prior to the choice, you might very well have been indifferent. You don't necessarily have to have had a secret leaning toward one more than the other. You know, there might be sort of, you know, two candy bars in front of you on the table and they're just alike, and you don't. You really are indifferent between them when you're not choosing. But in the act of choosing, then you're, you know, then you are not indifferent. And likewise, I want to say the way that Aquinas puts it is that the reason for your choice is a formal, not an efficient cause of your choice, meaning that to do something for a reason, it has to do with the way that your action is informed by reason right now. It doesn't mean it's kicked off by something earlier.
Yeah, I agree entirely with that. I think the basic point is when you're explaining an action by saying person has certain reasons for acting, it's not the case that those reasons need to be explained by some further causal factors of some kind, like there were certain events in the person's brain that were making him take those reasons to be the correct reasons. That's I don't think you that's an improper to do that, and I think that's where there are certainly philosophers who think that, but I think that's one area where certainly Rothbard wouldn't accept views of that kind. I think he was right not to accept them.
Question from the floor?
I guess this question is probably for Drs. Hulsman and Bagus, but obviously anybody can respond. Regarding your critique of Selgin, I think the case is very clear that in a case of a competitive bank that's running at 10 or 20% reserves, that's not going to be sustainable on the market competitively because other firms will run them out of business. But I think the case gets a little more murky at a much higher reserve ratio. I mean, other firms on the market don't have to accept these notes at par if or clearinghouses if these firms have significant doubts as to the solvency of a bank. So, I mean, assuming they aren't defrauding their customers and they've, you know, stamped a guarantee of having above a certain reserve ratio on the notes, is this not just part of the process of competition?
Well, the underlying problem is that it still allows for credit expansion and cession. I mean, it admits this and says when the demand for money goes up, then banks should expand credit, but not necessarily the real resources have increased. And then you cannot finance additional investment projects, even because there are not enough free resources to sustain them.
Of course, a bank fractional reserve system with 90% reserves works better than one with 10% reserve, than one with 1% reserve, and one with 0.1. Of course, so it's a gradual thing. Yeah, that's correct. But again, as Philip has said, I mean, this doesn't touch the principal arguments against it, right? The principal arguments concern things like, is it desirable from an economic point of view? Is it ethically justifiable? Is it desirable? Is it necessary? Is it necessary for the smooth operation of the market economy? The disagreement lies there. Is it desirable to go from 100% to 90%? That's the same question that you ask them when you raise the question, do you go from 90% to 20%?
Right. Yeah, I'm just going to point out that if a bank, let's take your figure, was it 90% or 80%? Let it be 90. If a bank expands credit, expands note issue, in response to an increase in the demand to hold money, then that does not put downward pressure on the interest rate. And that's one of Selgin's points. It simply accommodates that increased demand for money without there being a general downward pressure in prices.
I just want to point out that Misesian free banking, which Mises did support, as opposed to Selginian free banking, is vastly different in how they conceive the operation or an evolution of the free banking system. Mises supported free banking precisely because he thought it would lead to, in his words, a suppression of fiduciary media. And Mises' view of free banks was that each bank issued money substitutes, and people were interested in the money. That is, as long as they thought that that there was a secure, they were holding a secure claim, bank note or bank deposit, to money proper, to gold or silver or whatever it was, then the bank would be solvent. But Mises points out it's always on the precipice of insolvency. He says that any rumor that there's a problem will result in note brand extinction, okay? He says that, in other words, the money substitute will become extinct as soon as any doubts arise that there would be, that the bank will live up to its obligations. He goes on to say that the level of reserves doesn't matter. What matters is the reputation of the bank, and that can change instantly. So contrary to Selgin, he never thought that an increase in the demand for money is a reason for increasing the supply of money substitutes. He thinks that would, over time, you know, if there was a bad loan or rumor of a bad loan, a default or something like that, would instantly, even before the deposits were all turned in, cause the what's called the money substitute to go extinct. There would no longer, even though the guy had it in his hands and there was a good chance he could still get the money back, it would no longer circulate in exchange as a money substitute. So I support that as a second best. I think actually I think that today that's a practical way to get back to 100% gold standard, and that's what Mises thought.
Okay, thank you. We're going to take a break right now and start up at 5 o'clock. Question. What are the limits to contractual property covenants? For example, contracting to only sell a house to a certain race or religion forever.
Well, I don't think you can do that forever, because one of the main reason is that covenants or whatever, unless there's some trustee, can't outlast the person who's made, you know, the agreement with someone else. So when someone dies, he can't, for example, say that my this building can only be used for this purpose. Unless the trustees enforce that. But they don't have to enforce it either. I mean, there's no... I don't see in libertarian, under libertarianism, where the so-called dead hand of the past can determine property use in the future. Okay. I think it's up to the heirs. The heirs can, you know, whoever's the heir or the trustee can make a decision to do something different.
I don't think how you could not do this. I mean, you know, if you don't want to do this any longer, okay, you lose the title, and then then it becomes vacant property, and it's first come, first serve, right? So some other person who will take it over. I mean, why shouldn't? I mean, I'm very irritated by your response. Why should that not be the case?
I wasn't clear. What I was trying to say was that. The most anyone can do is to put the property under someone else's control when they die, either their heirs, who at that point can do anything they want with the property. The dead person has no property right in it. Unless he makes some kind of contract that, in the case that he changes it, then it'll, my pro- let's say I make this agreement with Roger, then my property will be remitted to Roger. Okay, you're my heir, let's say.
Okay. He's bound.
But he's not bound. The property goes to him, and he can do whatever he wants with it. So you
sign whatever you will. You kill the other guy. You're no longer bound.
No, I don't think you're. Well, you're murdering. You know, you can't have the property. I mean,
you're brave. He's dying, and you're no longer bound.
No, I don't think you can bind property. It's the will of the owner, and the owner has to be alive. You can't make a dead person's contract is no longer, you know, combined his wealth. I mean, if there's creditors out there, they can then take his wealth, but then they can do what they want with it.
So, I mean, what you're saying is that all the legal stipulations that we have right now and all the institutions that presently exist,
no.
For example, in the U.S., that they're all...
No, let's say property associations, for example, exist. And so that, you know, there's certain things, you can't paint your house a certain color and so on and so forth. Well, then if you do that, or if your heir does that, the person who you've willed it to, then he's breaking an ongoing contract. Because to live in that neighborhood, you're bound by the bylaws of the association. Those types of things will last.
What about something like Liberty Fund? There they are bound by that covenant. They have to be extinct also, I think, right? By 2025 or something.
I mean, if there's another layer of law there, but I don't see why that should be the case.
So why should they respect this? Why not just say, aha, we are alive.
When you give the property...
The old man has given us the money. He's dead.
I think when the property... My point is when the property right passes, when you die, the property becomes someone else's. It's no longer subject to your will.
You're a dead man.
You're a dead man.
Okay, we can't... get out of here without this question. Libertarians are usually smarter than other people. For the most of people, is better to be living in socialism. If we have a free market state, what do we do with these other people? What do we do with the dumb and lazy people?
Kill them and take their property.
From the fact that people believe they would be better off and happier under more state control, it doesn't follow that they actually would be. If, as a matter of fact, more of the of the things they want. Now, it depends what they want. You know, if they want power over other people, then, you know, it's probably statism is the way to go. But, you know, when it comes to, you know, goods and services and security and that sort of thing, which lots of people want a fair bit of, they may be statist because they believe that they'll get more of those things under state control. But if, in fact, they're wrong, then once they... And also, if they're statist simply because they sort of go along with the majority trends and they just sort of believe whatever it is that they hear most people that they respect saying, then in a free society, those people would just be, you know, wishy-washy, mindless, conformist Rothbardians. I'm not sure what that would look like, but you know, they would be relatively materially comfortable, and their views would fit in with the views of their peers that they're responding to, and so forth, and they wouldn't necessarily have to become statists. I mean, they will probably always be statists, just as, you know, there probably are still flat earthers somewhere.
Yeah, I'm not sure that the libertarians are the more intelligent or smarter. I just came across a quip by Hayek, and he said he'd wondered for years why so many intellectuals were socialists, as surely they are. And he said he finally figured it out. He says the intellectuals overvalue intelligence, which means they think they actually can run the country.
Question from the floor.
Okay. I had a question on, I think this relates to something Rothbard said, and he said it the most explicitly, talking about the lengthening of the structure of production. He said that any increase in investment, he said this in America's Great Depression and in Man, Economy, State. He says there's no arbitrary choice of investing between, quote, higher order and lower order goods. And any increase in investment always lengthens the structure of production. And I think he borrowed on Mises with this. And he said that if anyone wants to assert that an increase in the lengthen of the structure of production, well, like from any increase in investment, you say, well, it takes longer to make good A and B than good A using the same technology. And I was just wondering, one, if the panel members think that this is necessarily the case, and two, how that, I guess, relates to the business cycle, because people always say, especially Kaplan, he always says, well, why don't they just invest in projects like that? They don't invest in longer production processes. But if it's the case that any increase in investment lengthens production processes, wouldn't his criticism somewhat be nullified then?
Rothbard's also reflecting the Hayekian view too. And one of the setting in which that's true is a macroeconomic setting. In other words, he's talking about increasing the extent to which capital is tied up in the economy as a whole. Okay, and so if you add to the investment, that adds to the time that those investment goods are tied up without anything else changing, then that increases the overall time element in the factor of production. He's not necessarily saying that it's adds vertically as opposed to horizontally. In other words, it might not be a capital deepening, it might be a capital widening, but nonetheless, it adds to the extent to which resources are tied up in the production processes. Hayek makes that clear in the early pages of the Pure Theory of Capital. So I don't think he means it's a long drawn out process, the investment he's talking about, but it just adds to the extent to which resources are tied up in the economy. I'll mention that this business of roundaboutness or trying to measure roundaboutness, you get into a lot of thorny issues there that Hayek dealt with in Pure Theory of Capital, and without a satisfactory resolution.
Question. Explain in greater detail the left libertarian and mutualist positions and how it differs from our own. Who is right? I think we are. And why?
Okay, I guess that's for me. Left libertarian is a broader category than mutualist. So is this a question about property theory, about economic value theory? Did it say precisely what the question was?
Explain in greater detail the left libertarian and mutualist positions and how it differs from our own.
Okay. So it didn't specify between value theory and property theory, so I'll just quickly say something about both. So the standard mutualist position on property is that that labor and occupancy are not only conditions to homestead property in the first place, but also conditions for ongoing use. So you have to ongoing ownership. So you have to keep using your property in order to have continue to have a property right to it. And then the mutualist position on value, or at least there are different ones, but the one that's sort of the most dominant one is a subjectivized version of the labor theory value that says that if the price of that you get on the market for a good doesn't repay the subjective disutility to you of your labor in bringing it, then you won't. And if it's more than that, then it'll be cut down by competition, so it'll tend to approximate that. That's the mutualist view. Left libertarianism is a broader category than mutualists. It includes mutualists, but also includes like agorists and people who are more Rothbardian. I'm not sure whether there's, and I'm in the more Rothbardian, less mutualist side, and so I don't accept the labor theory of value, and I don't, although the subjectivized version seems to be defanged to a large extent, and I don't accept the mutualist view of land. So if you want me to defend it, I can try and use Verstehen, but it's not my view.
Anybody else? Question from the floor? Please stand.
What is the Austrian response to the neo-Ricardian critique of capital reverse and reswitching?
Yeah.
even the people that were on the Cambridge, England side of that debate eventually indicated that it was an irrelevant or unimportant. There are some that still like to try to beat the Austrians over the head with it. Joan Robinson wrote an article entitled "The Unimportance of Reswitching." Okay, but maybe a more basic criticism is that the Ricardian view of capital has a very different view of what capital is. In fact, in all of their little models, their little examples, capital takes the form of dated labor. In other words, you apply or you use two worker hours of labor at some point and it matures into output at some later point. Well, the units, and they measure that capital, is a physical unit, namely worker hour, right? So it's not really a unit of capital, because in my capital theory lecture I indicated that capital doesn't have any natural units of its own. That's one of the reasons that makes it a thorny issue. You have to measure it in value terms, and then you get a problem in using the price as a measure of the quantity. But if you deliberately measure it in physical terms, like a two worker hours, then you've got a different concept of capital altogether, and it's not at all surprising that the arithmetic you use in that situation would be different than what you get with the Austrian view. And the results of that little exercise in reswitching and technique reversing, capital reswitching, that doesn't have any implications at all about what the Austrians are doing with capital fear.
Two years ago, I've sent on the internet a paper which I tried to revise the Austrian capital theory by bringing into play the variations in the demand for savings. And so I developed scenarios that are similar, that resemble reswitching. So you get a decrease in the interest rate and at the same time a shortening of the structure of production. But as Roger Garrison has said, this has no implications for the themes that are really at the heart of the Austrian story about the operation of the market economy as compared to an economy laboring under the impact of monetary interventionism and government interventionism. That's the big theme. For the Austrians, right, the first analysis, how would the market operate under the impact of increased savings? So this is just a foil as compared to which you analyze subsequently the impact of interventionist policies. And that impact is always the same. Whether you have first reswitching or not, the impact is always that you disequilibrate the time structure of production. You get the phenomena that have been described by Mises and Hayek and others.
What is the name of your paper?
Structure of Production Reconsidered. You just type this, you'll find this easily.
Question. In Human Action, Mises, in discussing the nature of action, talks about passive action, where one does nothing to maintain the current state. It is action because one, nevertheless, chooses between differently valued ends and demonstrates a preference for constancy. Soon after, Mises discusses the prerequisites for action, a feeling of unease, an imagined state, better state, a belief that one has the means to bring about that state. For many actions, eating a sandwich, driving a car, etc., it is not hard to imagine how the prerequisites are satisfied. But the case of passive action seems like a non-trivial example that, perhaps, choice of language may be obscuring. What is the feeling of unease before a passive action? How does the imagined state differ from the one previously experienced? In ordinary terms, it doesn't make sense to say a man is feeling uneasy if he chooses to maintain his state. So how can this non-trivial example be properly illustrated in praxeology? And that wasn't easy to read either.
Yeah, I would say there are two ways you might think about felt uneasiness. So on the one hand, you might think of it as a feeling of dissatisfaction with the way things are. And in that case, then it does seem that it would be hard for that to motivate an attempt to keep things the way they are. But you could also imagine, in a broader sense, something like a feeling of being dissatisfied with the way things would be if you didn't act, and therefore being dissatisfied with a certain tendency, namely the tendency of things to stop being good if you don't do so. If you don't. Maintain them, and sometimes the way to maintain them is by doing nothing. So, for example, suppose that I'm balancing on the top of some narrow thing, and I don't want to fall off, so I just don't shift around a lot, and maybe I'm comfortable up there, so I'm not dissatisfied in the sense of I want to get off this precarious position, but I'm dissatisfied with the tendency that I would have to fall if I were to move, and so. That's a sense in which it's felt dissatisfaction. I think it's a broader, more abstract, more strained sense. And sometimes Mises talks as though he really has in mind some feeling of dissatisfaction with what's going on. Other times he talks more as if he means something more contentless, more purely formal, and where it could mean something like dissatisfaction with the way things would be if you were to act. David, do you want to add anything?
Yes, I agree. I think it's the second sense that's the more strictly correct one. And actually, it's interesting, that second sense, that actually invalidates an argument Mises gives that if there were God exists, he couldn't act because God is perfect and couldn't feel dissatisfaction. You see, that wouldn't follow because God could feel never feels dissatisfaction. It could be the case that if he weren't to act, he would feel dissatisfaction, but he doesn't because he acts. So I think there are problems with that argument. There are various further complications I won't go into, but I thought that's the second sense is really the one that I think the correct one to use.
Question from the floor.
Yes, just to clarify something in what has government done to our money, Rothbard says, many people believe in the days of the gold standard that coins were somehow more really money than plain uncoinage gold bullion. It is true that coins commanded a premium over bullion, but this was not caused by any mysterious virtue of the coins. It stemmed from the fact that it costs more to manufacture coins from bullion than to remelt coins back into bullion. Because of this difference, coins were more valuable on the market. So it seems to me that Rothbard is deviating from the subjected theory of value here. So I just want to be sure if maybe he committed an error when writing this. Thank you.
What Rothbard means there is that you are willing to incur greater costs or use resources of greater value to form the coin from the bullion because it's more convenient. So the subjective value does come in there. It drives the process which transforms the bullion into the coin, which happens to use more valuable resources and hence the premium.
It's just a very shorthand way of expressing.
The way it's stated seems like it's more valuable because it costs more.
But we often say things like this suit of clothes costs more because it's in this expensive mall and they have to pay a higher rent. But that's a shorthand way of speaking.
Question from the floor.
Yes, maybe stand up. I have a question about... if human action, we like to think of human action as being the most basic axiom there is. But if you read, for instance, in Man, Economy, and State, that Rothbard says that there must be scarcity because otherwise man would not act. I think there's a typical example of affirming the consequent. There might be tons of reasons why people act, and one of those could be scarcity. And I refer to that maybe as the metaphysical escape hatch. If you really want to be irrational, you could say, well, there is a God or a being that induces me to act. And you say, well, then God is acting. Yes, but God is you cannot conceptualize what he does. He is beyond all laws of the universe. So for somebody who really wants to be irrational, he can always go to the metaphysical level and claim that reality there is not what it is. And I wonder if and it has a lot of implications because there are other examples as well. So I wonder if the study of metaphysics would help the defense of the most basic axiom we regard as human action now.
No, I think what Rothbard says is that scarcity is an immediate implication of the fact of action.
But it's not.
Of course it is, because if there was no scarcity in the world, you'd be instantaneously satisfied. As soon as you wanted a chicken, it would be going down your teeth. Chicken, a cooked chicken would be going down your throat. There was an old commercial called rental car firm Avis, and it said, "Let Hertz put you in the driver's seat." And immediately, as soon as the guy wants the rental, he's coming down from the sky into the driver's seat. That's an absence of scarcity. And therefore, there would be no action. You'd be all your wants would be instantaneously gratified.
But you presuppose scarcity. That's why.
No, you're not presupposing scarcity. You're presupposing action is the axiom. For people to act, we see people acting. So we say, for people to act, there are certain inferences. They have to have time preference. They have to have. There has to be scarcity. That is, all that means that all their wants cannot be fulfilled by their available resources. That's all it means. This is just an immediate inference, as it's called by the philosophers.
Question. Can savings be hoarded?
Yes.
Question from the floor? I'm getting low.
I was recently confronted in a debate when I made a position on economic policy where I included, I guess I kind of mixed my Austrian economic views with my libertarian philosophy, and I was accused of the is-ought problem. Could someone, they were kind of talking past me, could y'all encounter that? Could y'all explain what that means and whether it's actually a problem or not?
Well, the is-ought problem is the claim that in philosophy that you cannot derive evaluative or normative ought conclusions from purely descriptive premises. And it's a matter of dispute in philosophy whether, in fact, that's true or not. But whether that's a problem depends on exactly what they were taking you to be doing. So if you said something like, if you do X, it will increase unemployment, therefore you shouldn't do X, they could say, well, wait a second, that doesn't follow without the additional premise that, unemployment is bad. You could say, all right, yeah, well, I fess up, I do believe that. But without knowing the details of exactly what great argumentative sin you committed, I do not know whether to absolve or condemn you. David, you want to add anything on that?
I guess one fallacy to avoid that if you think there is an is-ought dichotomy in the sense that you can't derive judgment what you ought to do just from purely descriptive premises, as Roderick says, that's very much disputed. But a lot of people think that if you accept that, that somehow implies that there aren't objective judgments you can make about ethics, that means, well, if you can't draw ought conclusions from descriptive premises, then it's up to us to make a decision on what to do. But that doesn't follow at all, because there can just be, for all that argument shows, there can just be judgment about what we ought to do that aren't based on descriptive premises but are nevertheless objectively true.
Question. What does economics assume about expectations when theorizing about an economy converging to the ERE? For example, from the plain state of rest to the final state of rest.
The economy never converges to the ERE or the final state of rest. That's just an imaginary tool. It tends in that direction at any given moment. But the configuration of the data, of the tastes and resources, continually change. So Austrians, unlike their neoclassical counterparts, do not believe that the ERE is a realizable or even a conceivable, logically non-contradictory state. Okay, we just use it to separate interest from profit by just assuming uncertainty away. The economy does not in real time, and this is where... there's some disagreement between Austrians where I would disagree, for example, with Israel Kirzner, where Israel Kirzner actually believes that the economy moves in a direction of equilibrium as a result of entrepreneurial decision-making. I would say no. What happens is that at every moment there's exogenous change in the data, and we move along a path in history. If you were to stop at any moment, there would be a tendency to move in that direction. But we don't have to worry about what the expectations would actually be like and so on, because we're never going to get very far. Mises says we may maybe take one or two steps in that direction before something else changes and moves the final state of rest and the final state of rest. The ERE is really irrelevant to any dynamic problem whatsoever.
Just another analogy. It's like saying do we all have a tendency to move toward the center of the Earth or to be at the center of the Earth? In a sense, yes, gravity's pulling us all in that direction. But that doesn't mean that over time we're all going to be moving closer and closer to the center of the Earth. And it's true that it'll be true if you happen to come across a big hole, then you will end up, you know, closer, though probably not very close. So yeah, it's a tendency, but the countervailing factors are so great and so pervasive that, you know, it's not a tendency that's actually going to get you to the center of the Earth, even if you should want to be there, which I actually don't recommend.
Question. What is the nature of animals in relation to human action? Do animals act?
Well, I think that's more of an empirical question. You have to look at particular animals. I think some of the higher animals would do sometimes simulate action. I mean, we have only to look at certain websites to see that. never mind that. But again, I don't think that's something you could settle just by thinking about it. You just have to just consider various animals. I don't think that's really a problem that comes in much about in praxeology.
I'll say a little bit about it. Certainly, Mises sometimes talks as though he doesn't think animals act. And it's really true that there are interesting differences between whatever it is animals do and whatever we do. On the other hand, I'm inclined to say, well, I mean, it makes sense to say that, you know, you can see means and structures in animal behavior. You can see, you know, something like preferences. It's an interesting question how much of what humans do you can attribute to animals. And animals are sort of notoriously tricky for philosophers to deal with, because there's always a tendency either to want to inflate them up to being like little humans, or else to downgrade them to being like robots, because it's so hard to grasp the intermediate form of consciousness they have. Because if you try to project ourselves mentally into it, we always want to bring stuff with us that it has very hard for us to engage in very detailed fish staying with them. But I'm glad to see. Yeah, that certainly some features of praxeology seem to apply to them. Because, if you've ever had a pet, you know your pet has preferences and acts on them.
I had a very clever dog, Pointer, and in the beginning when she was young, we used to say, "Let's take her for a walk," and she quickly learned walk. And then we used to spell WALK, and she quickly learned what that meant. And then I would look at my wife and say W or something like that, try to whisper it, but she had very good hearing, she'd hear. So finally, I would just go to the door to get her chain, and as soon as she heard the slightest jingle, she'd be right there. So, yeah, I think there's definitely some forms of action there.
Just tell one story. I remember Philippa Foot, who was a British philosopher, tended to stress that the lack of language limited the thought, the conscious action you could attribute to animals. He used to say, you might get a parrot who could say Polly wants a cracker, but you couldn't have a case where someone offered cracker to the parrot, and the parrot would say, no thanks, I'll take it later.
Question. Given the philosophy of language problems, how can two people be sure that a concept, say capital or action, is the same in both of their minds? Or is it simply that we can't be 100% sure?
Well, this is once again a case where Verstehen or phonology or the ability to enter into other people's. I read it in a book. the ability to enter into their minds. It's an ability we have. We know that we have it because society couldn't exist if we didn't have it, if we weren't pretty good at it. Now we all know we're not perfect at it, because And we're constantly misunderstanding each other, not just about you know, praxeological concepts, but about all kinds of things. So we know that we are fallible at understanding each other. But we also know that we're amazingly good at understanding each other, because if, you know, probably because if we hadn't been, we wouldn't, you know, society wouldn't have survived, and we wouldn't be here. So, you know, there's no magic bullet. There's no philosophical argument that's going to say, here's the proof that you know exactly what other people mean, or here's the proof that you don't. You just have to try in any case to, you know, work out and try to communicate it. But I don't think there's a philosophical magic bullet.
Question from the floor.
Okay. Partly to keep Professor Herbener from succeeding and going through the whole panel discussion without saying anything. First, could Professor Hulsmann briefly explain his interest theory, and then could Professor Herbener provide his criticism briefly? As briefly as possible.
There is an inherent value difference between means and ends. The reason why we choose means is to attain ends. If we had the opportunity to choose between a means and the ends that it produces, we would choose the end directly. We would not go through the means. We would always prefer the means, the end. So therefore, the end must have a higher value. Now, this relationship between means and ends is, of course, pervasive throughout the economy in the structure of production and so on. And so we have here, according to me, the root of the difference in monetary prices that are paid for factors of production as compared to the monetary prices that are paid for the products resulting from the interaction of those factors of production. That's very briefly it.
Time's up. Just kidding.
My very brief response is I don't see how this claim, whether it's true or not, relates to the intertemporal nature of interest.
Question. How to deal with the continuum problem when talking about the NAP / property rights?
All right, so I'm assuming that this is a question about you know, borderline cases. I suspect that something like David Friedman's examples are mine. David Friedman has this where he says, well, look, if I shine a laser on your house and it blasts through your door and blasts a hole in your door, I'm clearly violating your property rights. If I just shine a flashlight on it, it seems like I'm not. Or if I am, and you know, if I just shine a candle over in my house and the light ends up shining in your direction, that's not a violation of rights. So there are lots of cases where there are borderline cases where we want to say that, you know, well, clearly you can impinge causally on someone else without their permission in ways that are not violations of their rights. So what counts as a violation? And you know, I'm inclined to say this is one reason that a non-aggression principle considered simply in cosmic isolation from any other values or any other considerations of what ordinary social practices or the conditions of human existence are isn't going to give you very precise information. So you have to embed it. If we were different kinds of creatures, if we were creatures that much more or much less sensitive to various kinds of causal influences, I think that would make it a difference. I was just looking yesterday at an article by Walter Block, it's an article called, I forget the exact title, but it has Geography and Gun Control in the title. And in the course of connecting them, he explains that it would be permissible to ban guns if we all were crammed into a telephone booth. So here we have, you know, a Pinko deviation in Walter's part, as you'd expect. But anyway, so I would say that the implementation of a principle like that has to take into account the you know the fuzzy nature of human life. But if anyone wants to say something else.
I just add to that, I think it's a mistake sometimes libertarians make to think that problems of such boundary problems have solutions that don't depend on conventions of particular groups of people, that there's some fixed answer sort of to Friedman's problem. This is the exact limit, and if you can't come up with that, then there's some failing in the libertarian solution. It could just be people could just make arrangements that seem to them suitable, and if they were accepted, that would be enough. I don't think we need to look for the somehow non-conventional answer that's supposed to be there.
Last question from the floor.
Okay. This deals with welfare economics and...
No, stand up.
Oh, stand up. Oh, okay. This deals with welfare economics and I guess the concept of demonstrated preference or building on, I guess Rothbard says that an example of intervention is triangular intervention where someone prevents someone else, two people from making an exchange. So if I go and I were to kill someone, could that be an example of triangular intervention where I'm preventing an exchange from being made between someone else? Like if I kill this guy's, I don't know, girlfriend, is that an example of triangular exchange where the guy can't, you know, be with his girlfriend anymore? Do I have to necessarily have the intent of preventing an exchange in order for the boyfriend to be demonstrably hurt? Okay. All right.
Well, time's up anyways. You blew the last 4 minutes of the session. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen.